Welcome. I'm Jessica Teigen, and this is the Evolving to Exceptional podcast, where we talk about reaching peak performance in our workplaces, homes, and communities so that we can live our best life possible, an exceptional life. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Evolving to Exceptional podcast. I have Tom Fox here with me, and he is a compliance expert, as well as the founder of the only podcast network that focuses on compliance in the award-winning Compliance Podcast Network, which currently has 60 different podcasts. Tom, I am so excited to hear a little bit more about your background and about how compliance is impacting workplaces in general. But before we get to that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and why it is that you're so passionate about this area and this particular focus that you have really honed your career around?
Sure. I'm a recovering trial lawyer. I did that for about 25 years. Then I went to the in-house world, and that's where I learned about compliance, which I knew nothing about when I was a trial lawyer. And I started off doing contracts literally across the globe, a worldwide contract troubleshooter. And then I left that job and became a general counsel of a company who in 2007 had the largest corruption fine violation in the history of the world. I was part of the new management team that was brought in to not something like clean things up, but build out a compliance program. And that's where I learned about compliance. And so I learned the nuts and bolts of building out a program. The company got sold, so my job went away. I decided what I really wanted to do with my life was race bicycles. So I went off on this great adventure to race bicycles. I was over 50. I could ride in the senior division until one Saturday after Thanksgiving in 2009, I got hit by a Hummer, and that ended my cycling career. So I was banged up, and it took me a while to get to the point where I could work again. And so when I could get on my walker and toddle into my office, I realized I was going to have to go back to work. This was the second time I'd failed retirement, so I'm not going to fail retirement again. Anyway, it was 2010. I knew nothing about social media. I started Twitter, LinkedIn, blogging, Facebook, etc. And I decided what I really enjoyed was that my last corporate job was building out compliance programs. So I decided to be the nuts and bolts guy. And back then, there were very few lawyers in private practice who built out compliance programs. Because I was so banged up, the only time I left the house was to go to physical therapy. And so for 6 months, I literally beavered away in my office in what we now call working from home. Back then, it was just me staying at home. And I created a worldwide compliance practice out of that series of events. And I blogged. That led to book writing. The blogging led to podcasting. Podcasting led to founding the Compliance Podcast Network, as you said, the only podcast network. And the reason I'm so passionate about compliance is the UN estimates that $3 trillion is lost to the world economy every year due to bribery and corruption. If you add money laundering, it's another $2 trillion. So that's $5 trillion that could be pumped into the world's economy if we didn't have those two basic frauds. And so I decided that as a lawyer, I could make a difference in the corruption world or anti-corruption world. And that drives my passion to do the best I can do, to be the best I can be, and to try to get the word out in every way, shape, and form about the worldwide fight against the international scourge of corruption.
So tell us or help me and our listeners a little bit with, when you talk about compliance, what is it that you're meaning? What falls into that category? And what are the maybe big buckets or the major areas of focus that are of concern that you're paying attention to that could lead to those lost revenues or those lost profits due to that corruption or the integrity challenges that relate to the compliance space?
Sure. So generally, compliance means anything that helps an employee comply with a law. That can be healthcare, that can be an anti-corruption law, it can be an environmental law, it can be a worker safety law, whatever that might be. My form or my flavor of corruption is anti-bribery, anti-corruption compliance. There is a U.S. law that prevents U.S. companies from engaging in bribery and corruption outside the United States. And that's called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And that's the law I specialize in. So at first I became a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act guru. Then I became a compliance guru of how to comply with that law. There are many flavors and forms of compliance. There's data protection. There's money laundering. There's human trafficking. There's human rights and many other different forms. But I focus on anti-corruption compliance. Within that space, this U.S. law, it generates huge fines and penalties, literally billions of dollars a year in fines and penalties for companies who violate it. And they violate it by paying a bribe outside the United States to a foreign government official to obtain a contract.
So do you find, and that sounds like a pretty direct example, so I'm curious, maybe that kind of answers it itself, but do you find that individuals or these companies tend to know that they are violating compliance laws or crossing these boundaries and these legal limitations that are in place? Or is it often more so the result of ignorance and lack of understanding of what is and is not acceptable or what would violate the laws that exist within the United States?
So those two categories are certainly relevant and they are part of the discussion. But the biggest misstep companies make is in incentives, in financial incentives or non-financial incentives such as promotion. If your company incentivizes you to meet your numbers every month, every quarter, every 6 months, every year, and that's it, guess what? You'll meet your numbers, whatever that takes. If it's you meet your numbers or you're fired, you'll meet your numbers. And so what I and others try to talk about is it's not meeting your numbers, it's doing business ethically. That leads us to culture. So we try to help employees understand that our company is dedicated to doing business the right way. But for companies, they have to understand, they have to put the right incentives in place. And you can't simply give someone a discretionary bonus based upon their sales. There has to be other factors. It certainly can be a part of your discretionary bonus or your compensation, but it can't be, or it shouldn't be the only reason.
So what you're seeing is, and it's a great example, that individuals who have our workplaces and companies that have hired people abroad put these incentives in place, and that actually motivates people to cross these boundaries or these lines because they have to meet their incentives or they're not going to keep their jobs. And so that actually discourages them from doing the ethical thing in order to meet those numbers. Is that the most prevalent challenge? And what do you see in terms of that popping up across different organizations that you work with? Is that a pretty common issue that continuously shows up, or is it fairly rare or fairly isolated?
So it really is intertwined with all of the three things we talked about. So we talked about misincentives or malalignment of incentives, but it also speaks to the training employees receive. You're right that there's some people who didn't know that law existed, and they didn't know that there are certain requirements and some specific requirements under that law. There's a very small percentage of people that basically are fraudsters and don't care what the law is. You hope you weed those people out in the hiring process. But in addition to educating them and incentivizing them, you also have to disincentivize them, meaning you'll be fired if you engage in such behavior. But also you have to monitor sales and other data, which would tell you that you have a potential problem. So it's an integrated system, but it's really, and what's most interesting is in 2021, the regulators of this law, who are the U.S. Department of Justice, for the first time started talking about corporate culture and that it all comes back to corporate culture. Corporate culture means training people to do the right thing. Corporate culture means giving people the opportunity to raise their hand and speak up in a safe environment if they see something wrong. Corporate culture means hiring the right people. It means doing a background check. It means interviewing them, making sure that a potential hire has the values of the company, monitoring all of that going forward, and improving your processes if something slips through the cracks.
So I'm curious if, and that's extremely interesting that the DOJ is now focused on the cultural component. What I'm curious is how often, where there are these types of issues, where there are these employees that are taking these steps or these incentive programs, are there other cultural issues that are contributing to that outcome as well? Are there typically systemic issues that you see in terms of the organization overall, maybe a culture that dissuades people from speaking up or from raising or creating awareness to fraud or issues that are going on, if it's going to have a negative impact upon business or things like that? Do you find that there are other cultural problems in these organizations that extend beyond just the compliance with this particular law or compliance in general?
Certainly there can be cultural issues, and let's just pick probably the biggest cultural time of the United States, the month of December, whether it be Christmas, whether it be Hanukkah, whether it be some other major holiday, you, your family, and your friends celebrate. This is a tradition of giving. And that tradition can extend to your customers. It can extend to people you do business with. It can be extend to your vendors. What's an appropriate gift? Is an appropriate gift a new car? I think most people would say no. But is an appropriate gift a dinner to a nice restaurant? Is it an appropriate gift to give two football tickets in a box to the Houston Texans or Dallas Cowboys or what used to be called the St. Louis Cardinals? Is it appropriate to give two tickets to someone who's never been to a St. Louis Cardinals World Series game? You may think that is an excellent way to develop a good relationship with your customer, and you may be absolutely right, but that may be too much. Is it appropriate to send a bottle of wine? My favorite is in Texas, we get pecan pies. Is something like that appropriate? Absolutely. So that's one example of culture. But that example, if you take it to other parts of the world, in China, it's the Chinese New Year. And there's literally a tradition of cash gifts called red cards, and where you put some amount of money in an envelope and you give it to someone. That's highly discouraged under U.S. law of giving of cash. You can give a gift or something else that is a show of gratitude and friendship, but it needs to be not unseemly. What is not unseemly? Well, that's a wide variance. Is it $50? Is it $100? Is it $500? Is $500 in Beijing the same thing as $500 in Mogadishu? So you have to look at sort of those cultural types of factors. So you can be within a culture that it is absolutely acceptable to provide a gift, and indeed maybe something that's expected, but you have to temper that amount of gift giving. What if you want to bring a client or a potential customer from China to the United States or from Singapore, India, you name the country? Well, there are actually some pretty specific rules about that. You have to fly them coach class. You can't allow them to bring their family and wives. If you bring them to your corporate home office for business meetings, you have to bring them to your corporate home office and not Disneyland or not Disney World. Can you entertain them while they're in the United States? Back to St. Louis. Can you take them to a St. Louis baseball game? Absolutely. Two tickets, beer and hot dogs, whatever that might be, is certainly fine. But it has to be a small percentage of their overall time at your corporate office in America. So those are some of the examples around gifts, travel, and entertainment where culture can vary widely across literally the world.
Where does the risk come into play? So how does the DOJ get involved and become aware of these types of issues where it then rises to the level of a compliance issue and the major fines that you talked about earlier?
There are multiple different ways that the Department of Justice can become involved. One is someone can contact the Department of Justice directly, whistleblow to the department. A company's competitors may be under investigation, and a company, then the DOJ does what's called an industry sweep. So I'm from Houston, or I was from Houston, and energy obviously is a big part of Houston. The first energy sweep, 04 to 07, was in energy. And then the DOJ moved to other sectors, such as healthcare, such as tech, hardware, software, pharmaceuticals, medical devices, private equity, investment firms, and they figure out how the bribes are occurring in one industry, and then they'll do a sweep through that industry. The biggest manner for the DOJ to find out about potential violations is through what's called self-disclosure, where a company determines it may have violated the law, or it at least thinks it has, and they self-disclose to the Department of Justice. Now, why would you go tell the Department of Justice you've engaged in a potential felony criminal violation? It's because the incentives for doing so are so great. If you self-disclose, if you remediate, if you cooperate with the Department of Justice and you pay back any ill-gotten gains, the Department of Justice will give you what they call legally a declination, what the rest of the world would just say a clean pass or a clean bill. And so there's incentives for both the regulators and others to self-disclose. There's incentives for companies to really do the right thing. But the Department of Justice has multiple other sources to find out about companies. And really the last thing you want is to have the FBI knock at your door with a search warrant for potential bribes and corruption when you had no idea it was coming.
So when it comes to these types of issues that rise to that level of DOJ action and investigation and the fines that come, is there a level of awareness that organizations have to have of what is transpiring? Or is it quite literally you've got a salesperson in another country pretty deep in the organization, but their decisions then ultimately reflect on the overall organization and cause that level of issue or the financial liabilities or risks to the organization?
As the second part of that question, the company is 100% liable for the actions of its employees. The legal doctrine is called vicarious liability. But what it means is if you have an employee embedded in India and they engage in bribery and corruption and you knew nothing about it here in the United States, your company is 100% liable for that employee's action. But the other part of a compliance program that I haven't talked about is called internal controls. And internal controls are the backbone of every compliance program. And they should allow you to detect any violation that comes up. It's financial controls, and every compliance program is designed to do three things: prevent, detect, and then remediate or fix the problem. And the detect prong is there to detect if something happens which allows a bribe to be paid. You hope you prevent it, because if you prevent it, then you never get in legal trouble.
Which do you think, is there one that's more important than the other, the internal controls or ensuring you have that specific guidance and those checkpoints to check up on people and make sure that those activities are not happening, or the cultural side that sets the tone for the training, the environment, the ethics, the foundation that would lead to lower risk or lower potential corruption and bribery issues arising? Is there one that's more important than the other, or one that tends to have a bigger impact than the other, or are they both essential?
So they're actually both essential, but I would put culture first. Because if your organization's culture is, we're going to do business the right way, and if you see something, say something, raise your hand and speak up, and we will not retaliate against you. We will investigate it, and if there is a problem, we will clean it up, is by far the best thing you can do. But what a compliance program does is, Ronald Reagan used to say, trust but verify. So trust but verify. You trust your employees will do the right thing, but you verify that through a compliance program. There are 8 general steps to any compliance program or a compliance program that complies with any law. And most generally, they are tone at the top, meaning management says and does the right things, code of conduct, policies and procedures that people are trained on, and then internal controls. You assess your risks, and then you manage your risks. Number 5 is the training, but it's training and communication. It's not one and done. You get anti-corruption training when you come, and you never get it again. It's sort of continuous reminders. There is incentives to do business the right way, hopefully in a form of some component of your annual review and or discretionary bonus, but also discipline or disincentives. Ongoing monitoring, meaning people are looking at all of this. again and again, and then hopefully continuous improvement. So those are the general steps of a compliance program. It all starts with culture, and the compliance program should follow directly behind culture, and they are very related. But if your culture is toxic, or if your culture is sell, sell at all costs, it really doesn't matter how good your compliance program is. People will figure out what is valued around here, and they will do it.
I can't agree more that when that culture has those systemic issues or those systemic ethical challenges, it's going to permeate everything. And so it's not really a surprise that it would also step into the compliance and ethical components of the organization, and that people are going to look to those leaders and look to what is in place, what they've been trained on, as direction as to what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. Is there something that's driving the importance of this, or the need to pay more attention to this now than maybe has been different in the past?
Sure. So when I started in 07, compliance was seen as either Dr. No or the land of no, populated by Dr. No, meaning the land of business non-development, or something that was written by lawyers for lawyers, meaning you have a 38-page code of conduct, single-spaced, that no one could read, even lawyers, and it was of no use to anyone. So, as I would say, written by lawyers for lawyers. And compliance was viewed as very legalistic. That thinking has evolved to the point where compliance is seen as a business process. And if it's a process, then it can be studied, it can be monitored through data, and it can be improved. So if you begin to see this as a process, then you begin to see you can improve compliance. That process went from about 2014 to the pandemic. And then literally in October of 2021, in a speech, the Deputy Attorney General, who is number two at the Department of Justice, said, we're going to start looking at culture. And we're going to assess your culture. We're going to ask you questions about your culture. We want to know what your culture was like. And this is the first time we've heard the Department of Justice, the regulators, say, we believe culture is important. Well, when the regulators say it, everybody listens. And so since that time, companies have been really, not, I don't want to say struggling, but moving towards trying to put that culture in place that would pass muster, but really lead to people doing business ethically and for the right reasons, so that, yes, you still have a compliance program, but you're not having 20% of your workforce trying to cheat you and get contracts through bribery and corruption.
So given the extent to which you have to put in place paying attention to culture, the control systems, I think a lot of times people think of compliance as being something that only really large organizations have to focus on or pay attention to. Is that still true today, or is it necessary for different size types of organizations to also be aware of or paying attention to these types of issues?
So what's been most interesting for me around compliance is seeing the evolution of compliance. I've talked about that a little, but the evolution has been driven from the business side of things. So I came out of the energy industry, and here's what happened starting in about 07, 08, when there were multiple multi-million dollar enforcement actions. Companies said, we can't afford this anymore. We're going to put compliance programs in place. So in the energy industry, it's pretty stratified. There are three operating companies, Shell, Chevron, and Exxon. There are four companies that do business with them. Those are called service companies: Halliburton, Weatherford, Baker Hughes, and one other. But to do business with any of those four service companies, you have to have a compliance program in place. It doesn't matter how big or how small you are. And I give this as an example because I actually did the legal work for this company. They were a software company, $15 million. They had one piece of software that did something that one of those service companies was interested in. They were too small to have their own sales agents, so they had commissioned sales agents. And I told them, I said, if you want to have a contract with any of those service companies, or you want investment dollars, you're going to have a compliance program in place. And I finally convinced them to let me do it. 2 weeks later, one of those service companies came and made a big investment. Their second question was, after let us see your financials, was, we want to see your compliance program. And so what happened in the energy industry has now happened in multiple other industries. It is a business-driven solution. If you want to do business in that industry, you have to have a compliance program in place. And it's not a market differentiator. It's not best in class. It is table stakes, meaning if you don't have a compliance program, we will not sign a contract with you and you cannot get work. So that's what's driven compliance and the evolution of compliance, because companies certainly want to do business with other companies that do business ethically, but they also want to know those companies aren't going to get them in trouble. It's really now become a business driver. And I now see the same thing, for instance, with ESG. Once again, I represent a lot of small little subcontractors and I do their contracts. And I see the Shells, the Exxons, the Chevrons say in their contracts, we have the right to audit your ESG program. That means you have to have an ESG. You have to be willing to show it. So that's as important as the regulators saying all of these things. It's really when businesses say, you have to have a compliance program to get our business. That's what drives, and that's what's made the biggest change.
So does the DOJ investigate these smaller contractors and organizations, or is the primary driver really just in order to get the contracts that you want to get, regardless of the size organization you are, you have to then have the compliance program to be in compliance with for the larger organizations?
It's really both.
Okay.
Because for most companies, it's going to be the latter, which is the business driver. But if you don't have it and the DOJ comes knocking, that's when you're going to get in trouble. And you can't get insurance for a criminal penalty like you can for a personal injury or something else. So it can literally put a company out of business. And if you're a small company and you get in trouble, it's going to negatively impact those you are doing business with. So it all works together. The regulators in many ways lead, but companies pick up on those signals and move forward to putting those requirements in their contracts as well.
Do you tend to see the biggest issues? We talked pretty heavily about the issues abroad and in the global climate and the different types of cultures and how that impacts what's reasonable, what's not reasonable in terms of gifts or bribery. Do you tend to see that most of those issues do arise out of the cross or global types of relationships versus organizations that are maybe primarily or even exclusively operating within the United States?
So my focus as a lawyer is this foreign law. So that's why I focus on that. But 37 states in the United States have commercial anti-bribery laws. Every state has a law which says you cannot bribe our government officials. Every state has that. And the 37 states say you cannot engage in commercial bribery, which would be bribes, me paying you a bribe to get something, a contract or work or come on a podcast. It's established within the United States that the same rules apply. But in other industries like healthcare, it is highly regulated inside the United States. And sunshine laws, for example, prevent pharmaceutical companies from paying doctors to write prescriptions. And if we want to go back to our earlier discussion about gifts, travel, and entertainment, okay, the pharmaceutical sales representative says, I'm not going to pay you to write a subscription, but I'm going to send you and your wife to Disneyland or Disney World for a week. And oh, by the way, could you give us a 30-minute talk at our conference? Well, that's going to be deemed inappropriate and a violation of HIPAA, not HIPAA laws, but sunshine laws. So the healthcare industry is highly regulated. There's a class of businesses in the United States called regulated industries, which is insurance, broker dealers, and financial institutions. They have an equally robust set of anti-corruption laws inside the United States. I just don't happen to play in those spaces, but they exist.
So I think a lot of people can get, because you said it yourself, that it's not necessarily something people do without a business or risk factor analysis that leads them to focus on compliance and integrate compliance. Is there a way to make compliance more interesting, more engaging, to get people to pay attention to it, to recognize its importance and the role that it plays, and especially in how you train and set that kind of cultural environment. If people tune out of the training that they're in, they're not going to get anything out of it. So what can you do to make it something that's maybe more engaging or interesting?
Sure. And that's a great question. And it's a problem that has existed in compliance since there was a compliance function. My first compliance training was a 268-slide PowerPoint deck that took 7 hours. 30 seconds into it, the sales guy's eyes had rolled inside their head. Right, Lisa? You can't do that. You have to give engaging training that entertains as well as tells a story. Now, there are some employees who are gatekeepers called that need perhaps more focused training. That can be people in accounts payable. It can be lawyers. It could be the accountants, internal auditors, those types of folks. But for the vast majority of employees, they need to be reminded once a year, we've got a code of conduct that says we're going to do business ethically in the right way. You don't even have to say we're not going to pay bribes. And then give them some examples. And I'm a big advocate, as you probably guess, of podcasts. Guess what? You can use internal podcasts to communicate. I did a series for a company of compliance through the lens of Star Trek, the original series, because I'm a huge TOS fan. So what are the compliance lessons from each episode? You can do something like that. I have a friend that is a former stand-up comedian, and he does videos that are just comedy shorts, and they're around compliance. So there's a variety of ways you can bring a effective, engaging communication that entertains to employees to help remind them of the importance of compliance. But management, literally the CEO, has to set the tone, and that CEO sets the tone and everyone else follows it. It can be very effective. Or I had a friend who was a compliance officer in 2015. Volkswagen had a huge scandal. And the CEO that Monday called his compliance officer and said, I'm going to do a video this week on Volkswagen because that's not the way we do business. He was a power company in Houston, nothing to do with auto, but he found it such a powerful teaching moment that he used that, created a video, shot on an iPhone, $500 total cost, and he put it out to his entire company. So you can do things in a very cost-effective manner. And in addition to my passion around compliance, the other great thing about being a compliance specialist is you are only limited by your imagination. If you can think of it, you can do it. So if there's a better way to communicate than what I've articulated, do it.
I absolutely love that. I think anything you can do to take what is typically considered, like you said, the lawyers talking to the lawyers and make it more interesting and engaging will make, I think, a huge difference in the cultures that are trying to implement the right practices to get the outcomes. Tom, thank you so much for coming on today. I want to give you a chance to give any final thoughts or words of wisdom that you have for our audience, either with respect to compliance culture, what they should be paying attention to. What are your final thoughts as we wrap up this episode?
So my final thoughts are pay attention to your culture, assess your culture, work to improve your culture, measure your culture, and then continuously improve that, then start it up again. And if you do that, I think you'll be going a long way towards preventing anything bad happening to your company. But remember the nuts and bolts of compliance. Those are important too, because if a regulator comes knocking, they're going to want to see the backbone of your program, internal controls, policies, and procedures. And as you said, better than I could have, entertain while you communicate.
Thank you so much, Tom. I think you just shared a ton of really valuable information with our audience around a really challenging topic and one that I think can often get overlooked or underscored as people believe that everything will work out, it'll be fine, it's not that big of a risk, only to find out later that things are much worse and much more challenging and costly than they ever anticipated. So the more that we can integrate these compliance practices, look at how to tie them to our cultures of engagement and employee performance so that you create those ethical, high integrity, high performing, employee practices that will lead to the results that you want, and to put in place the controls that you need on the back end to make sure that you can trust and verify the actions of your people and your workplace. So thank you so much, Tom, for being with us here today and sharing just so much valuable information about compliance.
It was my pleasure, Jessica. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. And as always, to our audience, just a reminder to just always keep evolving, keep growing, keep improving throughout your life, throughout your workplaces, and throughout your growth and development in general.